welcome to a brand new podcast brought to you by La Jolla Christian Fellowship called Faith, Facts, and Feelings. I am Pastor Adam Statmiller, and I'm with two good friends, and I'll let them introduce themselves. To my right is...
My name is Chris Bateman, and I'm a licensed marriage family therapist here in San Diego.
And used to be... You have a nickname, though.
Oh, yes, and I go by Bucky.
Bucky. We're going to give you a little backstory on that in a minute. And to the left, one of my favorite people in the world.
One of the best.
You're talking about yourself?
we're just best friends, but I am one of the best. But, yeah, it's youth pastor extraordinaire, Harry Wilson.
Right. Part-time janitor.
Part-time all of the jobs that happen at this church.
It's funny what pastors do.
Everything.
It's what we don't do. We've been chefs together.
What don't we do?
What don't we do? We build stages. We do all kinds of stuff. Well, hey, we are excited to get together to jump into the podcast world because the world needs another podcast.
That's so bad. So bad.
And it's funny, Chris here, or Bucky, I'm just going to go by Bucky, and I, we're kind of getting the band back together.
Kind of after almost 30 years.
30 years, yeah. So back in 1990, we were at Point Loma Nazarene College, and before they actually had a real radio station, I say we had a radio show, but we were
it was a table with a microphone and a broadcasting
and some speakers. Yeah. Some big speakers at the K-Band, which was Kickback Area Music, is what it was called. Yes. It was so we would sit there, everybody would kick back after lunch, and we would do some gags, and it was kind of a radio show, dude. I mean, there was tens of people who loved it.
Yep, while they were kicking back.
While they were kicking back. So, but we had a great time doing that. I want you to get some of those original tapes, and we will let the listeners...
I have them somewhere.
You will. Yeah, you have those.
I don't know if listening to them will make them any better. I think they're better in our memories than they are.
Yeah, we would do openings every week, and they were funny. And I had a huge CD collection, and so we would just pump out CDs. And by the way, every time you guys set something down on there, it's going to go bump, bump, and people are going to go, what's that noise going on? It's going to be drinks on the thing. So I'm not editing that out. This is a free flow, and you dress up like Joe Rogan today. There's no video, but you look like Joe Rogan, Chris.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Take that as a compliment.
Joe Rogan wear a lot of V-necks.
The deep V.
That is a deep V, dude. That's out of your belly button almost. That's solid.
That's not true.
Shallow V. Yeah.
Well, hey, we were wanting to come together to talk about just a whole bunch of different things. Obviously, faith. Faith in this society and this culture is changing and it's morphing like it always has been. I believe faith is on the rise. I believe God is on the move, and we want to talk a lot about that. Also want to talk about feelings. That's why Chris is here. You're really into it. Cuddled a lot back in the day and got... No, we never cuddled.
No, never cuddled.
But actually, from an emotional standpoint, you have some strong background there. And Harry, what's your major?
Psych major, yeah. Finishing up at Point Loma.
At Point Loma. So three... We should get a sponsorship.
Yeah,
should we call
Sea Lions.
Sea Lions.
That's it.
So we were the Crusaders.
We
were
anymore.
Politically incorrect.
I don't know if we're actually the Sea Lions anymore, are we?
I think so.
Because those are endangered species, so what are we now?
I thought we were still the sea. I don't know.
Okay.
We are. I don't think they have an actual mascot, though, anymore.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They did take it away from the games. They used to have someone who would dress up in a sea lion outfit and be
like a lion.
No, not
anymore. Was it a budget line item problem, or was that during 2008 bubble? We lost it, or what?
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know.
It's very controversial.
Nonetheless, and we were there when it was a college. And you were there when it's a university, although it kind of upgraded our diplomas because now we're university students.
I know. I actually want to go back and get a resubmit so I can get a one that says university on it.
Oh, really?
I think now they're like big and beautiful. Ours were like
I just had a
3x5 card.
I just had a squirrel that Harry and I, when we were exterminators, squirrel. Mm. We didn't kill him. We got him out.
Yeah,
but I had a squirrel in my office this summer and... Man, I gotta tell you, in 12 hours, a squirrel can do some damage. You ever seen that Tommy Boy with the deer? Destroyed my office and ate my diploma. So
you have it in glass or?
I did. I had it in glass, and it was. I didn't actually have it on the wall. I'm not like a big wall diploma guy, like a paper diploma guy. Mm-hmm. But no, he chewed that thing up.
You had yours in a basket of nuts.
So, as we were talking about what we want to talk about, we want to talk about faith, we want to talk about emotions, and different topics in regard to that, and we also want to talk about facts, some of the things that, truth, is really big these days. And what is truth? That's something that Pilate asked Jesus. I think it's a great question. Talk a lot about the questions of the Bible. We're going to bounce around from different topics of the day that are happening. Probably look at some of our sermon series, look at some of the things that Harry's doing, some of the things that Chris is doing and the things that he's speaking about, and talking through all the different issues to do that. So hopefully it will be informative. We want to jump right into it and into the deep end. Chris, you and I were talking about where to kind of go, and I saw across my news feed on my phone, and they always love to use the word mega pastor. Like anything that happens in a small church has no meaning, but when it happens at a mega church, which I'm not sure what that means anymore. But a guy by the name of Jared Wilson, pastor, ended up taking his life during Suicide Prevention Month, I think.
Was a
huge advocate for mental health. Mm-hmm. Was helping with fundraisers and I don't know some of the other things that you guys saw online. He was at Harvest, which is a big church, with Greg Laurie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Greg Laurie has had some, lost a son, mm-hmm. as well as had some pretty heavy stuff go on. But it kind of seemed that this one kind of just came at just at the right time for us, at least, in regard to maybe get some hope and some help to people. As we heard about the story, tragic story. Guy had two kids, right?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, two kids.
Sounds like it.
Wife. And what happened there. And so kind of as we look into that, I want to obviously look about kind of how our culture has changed a lot. Because did you know anybody, Chris, in high school that committed suicide? Even in college?
I knew a lot of people who struggled with suicidal thoughts, but when we were there. And it's interesting, when I was a younger man, when people would go through a depression or even have suicidal thoughts, there's this like, oh crap feeling that I felt of I don't know what to do with this, or and just a backing away.
I just
don't know what to do. Kind of like if somebody goes through a divorce or somebody has somebody that dies, we often don't know what to say. And I remember those feelings. We had a friend, my roommate in college, I remember he was going through a bad breakup, and my response to him was, oh, just get over it. Come on, let's go do something. Let's get out of it, snap out of it,
and move
on. And I mean, that's
30 culture. Years. Yeah, culture's moved on from that. I remember
for sure.
That. Yeah, definitely had some movement. I personally, I'm glad Harry's here because you're what, 25? Mm-hmm. I'm 50, so we're in a different age. Like I never remember anyone. I don't know anyone from high school that committed suicide. Now maybe there's. Goodness, now that they're older, maybe that would be you would see some of the people I went to high school now at our age doing that. But during high school, and I went to high school in the 80s. I mean, I got to say that the 80s was full of hope. Mm. I mean, there was no wars. Obviously there was some conflict. It wasn't like we had a Vietnam going on. The music was bright and hopeful and poppy. I mean, you had depressed mode, as a, call it or joke around. But I don't remember that. And then even in college, there was nobody that committed suicide from our Point Loma crew or, what about you in the night?
Yeah, I think it was my sophomore, junior high school. I remember kid total shocking to the whole community, but a kid named Eric took his own life, right at La Jolla High School. Football player, really popular kid and super unexpected, but. Totally remember that.
And we have a family in our church who had a son that went to La Jolla High, who also took his life. And we've had actually multiple in the community since I've been leading here that we've seen that. But
And statistically, since 1999, the suicide rate has just gone up. There's been no decrease in it. So.
So they're obviously tagging that to kind of the rise of social media. And you see a lot of people pinning it to that.
I think that's part of it for sure. Yeah. I think it's as most things are multifactored, but I would say social media, especially starting from a young age, and really not just social media in general, but as more also just the transformation of our phones, not just, being able to Google anything, kind of the constant connection to to our phones versus being totally present. That shift and that actual starting an addiction from a young age to a screen, I think definitely contributes to part of that reason that's going up.
Yeah, the first time that I came kind of in contact with thinking about suicide on a grander scale, because my wife's brother took his life, and he was young. He would have been about 40 now, and he was part of that, Nirvana generation, mm-hmm. And that's, I was youth pastor when Kurt Cobain took his life, and I remember talking to my kids about it, and it kind of came onto the radar, and, the music, especially coming from white suburbia, began to change. This is something I've been fascinated with, the music and looking at how white suburbia started hating their life. Kurt Cobain was a great example of that. If you hear some of his interviews, or was it Beck? I'm a loser, baby. So right. why don't you kill me?
Sure.
You had that song by Lit. I'm my own worst enemy. It's no surprise to me. I am my own worst enemy. Right. You look at Green Day. Was it? I was just listening to that song today.
I walk
a lonely road. Yeah.
I'm the only road I've ever known.
Yeah. I love it. It's a really good song. Yeah, totally. But that whole melancholy, thing that started happening with a group of people that are considered, in today's terms, privileged. Mm. You know what I'm saying? They're starting to write these, I feel that sometimes the music precedes the movement, the art precedes the movement. When did you guys start first see, you grew up in it. Harry, what was your take on that? Or you, because you weren't even around when Cobain was there.
I don't know. I think that was the stuff I was immediately drawn to, music that was very contemplative and inwardly dark. That was always the music that, I can think back back to middle school, I was listening to Eminem and whatever. I was always drawn to a more introspective, darker tone. So I don't know. For me, I think it's been, I grew up in it and I kind of related to it in a way.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I want to ask why we relate to it.
I think there's always been teenage angst, even in the late 50s when Elvis came out. What do we do with all this emotion that we have as teenagers and as young people? And that comes out, it's both a reflection of the music and it cycles back in.
But teenage angst of the 60s wasn't, I'm sad, I'm going to kill myself. As I watched Quattrofenia, I was in Brighton Beach in England, and that's where the movie was filmed. It was about these mods fighting the rockers and whatever. But the whole point was we had this angst, but we're alive. We're alive, and we're changing
things.
There's
a separation, and there's always like that for me. Like, I love the angst. I remember even in very early high school, probably like 15, and I would take the 30 bus right here in La Jolla, an hour to the gym. But I would just put on a hoodie, put on headphones.
You were Eminem.
And I'm busting
Eminem. Oh, you were 8 Mile.
And I'm 8 Mile Road. digging it. And it's all negative, all dark, all just bad. And I'm having a great time. And I just thought I was so cool in that moment.
Right.
But there was no...
No, I've run to that.
And there was no like, wow, life sucks. I actually want to.
But when life starts to suck, don't you start identifying with it more? I mean, if that becomes, if you're constantly putting in that into your heart, because I believe that everything we allow into our eyes and our ears and our minds seeps its way down to our heart, and it is out of the overflow of the heart that all of your actions come from, the scripture says.
I think you're totally right. I think there's in some ways, there's an, you do identify with it more, and in some ways, it's an outlet for you to go and identify that as truth. You're like, man, life does suck. And that does, and I find that as I've gotten further from that lifestyle, like I can't even listen to Eminem anymore. Like it would, even sometimes where I'm like, oh,
Mama
I used
drama.
To dig that. And it, there's an old song that comes up on my phone and like 30 seconds into the song, I'm hitting change because because my what I've identified as truth is so different now that I couldn't even. So yeah, I think it does.
Does it come from feeling, Chris, that maybe you can't change it? Because I think the '60s generation felt like they could change it.
Yeah, I think. I don't think necessarily that music causes people to commit suicide, or, you know, 90% of people.
No, but it's the soundtrack of suicide.
90% of people who commit suicide have, at the time of their death, have a mental health issue that can be treated. Right. And so so there's that piece of it. And I heard somebody describe it as like when you get in the car and somebody cuts you off, and in that moment, everything narrows to, I have one decision here to just yell at this guy and go off. And,
right.
and you, everything kind of focuses in, and your options feel very limited. And with some mental health issues, you find yourself in that space where it's like, oh, I don't have any options, and I'm just stuck in this. And the one option I have is to get out. And to and so, for sure, I think music and cultural things that point you in that direction can... that it tends to, like, you get a yellow car and you see yellow cars everywhere,
right,
kind of thing. So you pick up those things that you're focused on, but there's this feeling, I mean, the people that I've sat with in counseling, there's this feeling of, I'm stuck, I don't want to be here, and I think as far as the culture piece goes, it feels like people are much more isolated. You know, there's a weird paradox that's happening in that we're more connected than ever. I know what my person, you know, I can look up my freshman English teacher on Facebook.
See what he had for dinner.
Yeah, and actually literally see what he had for dinner. And then, but yet I feel like I'm doing that from the isolation of my phone sitting in a coffee shop or whatever. And so there's a sense of connection, and it feels like I should be connected, but I'm completely disconnected from people who can actually, I think that's some of the difference between 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. Now we have the internet, and we're connected, but we're not connected. Mm-hmm. And we have a deluge of information coming in that really is paralyzing. It's like so much coming into the funnel at once that it just gets jammed up. And young people are just, that's what I'm seeing. It's super anxious, super depressed, high performing.
Yeah, there's not enough bandwidth. I've always said we were created to be agrarian people and to not know what is happening within a 2-day horse ride of where you're at.
Yeah.
You know, if they're fighting in Yemen, why should I care?
Right.
You know, what I care about is that my grandpa is fighting with, you know, the Hatfields are fighting with the McCoys down the corner, and then that's going to be anxiety. But there's just way too much that's coming in, and then I don't. And the other thing that I've thought a lot is that there's our hearts and our minds are supposed to work together. The Bible talks about this, the mind of Christ, but it also talks about the heart being an emotive place, but the place where they have the ability to believe. We believe in our hearts. When our hearts get shut off because of brokenness, whether it be a broken home, whether it be bad experiences, molestation, whatever the thing is, we shut our hearts down. And then when we shut our hearts down, our minds are forced to take on the heavy lifting, and they're no longer yoked together like two oxen. Christ even talks about that. So I figure that broken hearts break minds. And so when people shut their hearts off, all of a sudden everything is being loaded into your mind and it's being broke. So that's one of the things. And we live in a culture that breaks hearts. We live in a heartbreaking culture, and that's difficult. I didn't want to. I'm not trying to put everything down into, oh, the music is. I'm not saying that. But what I'm saying is, you see a shift. You see these cultural shifts. What people are watching.
Yeah. Well, and it makes sense to try and make sense of something that doesn't make sense. You talk about Jared.
Yeah.
And it's like he was in the church doing this work. But he was just depressed and struggled with these intrusive thoughts, and so some of it doesn't make sense from just if you're in a healthy, normal state.
Right. Well, we'll turn the corner and talk about emotional health in the church in a moment. I want to keep looking. I mean, I kind of want to keep looking at why do we think we've turned this corner? So, for instance. I have Sirius Radio now. We got a car, and it came with 3 months of free Sirius Radio. So I'm checking it out. And they have a 1940s station. And I was with my daughter. And everything is, because they're in war, the music that everyone wanted to listen to was like jazz hands, ba-da-da-da-da-da, you know, and everything is either a song about, you know, getting people ready for war, they're actually talking about, like, go down to the recruiter, you know, that type of stuff.
Boogie Boy.
Yeah, yeah, and it was the Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy. Yeah, I'm surprised I was able to say that. But there was this sense that was fighting against what was really happening in the culture. And because something so bad was happening in the culture, they were actually, at least in Americana, and I want to make sure, you know, I understand that there's a whole world out there besides America, but we happen to live in America, and that's a lot of people we're talking to. This whole sense that the music wasn't going to identify, we were going to fight what is happening in the culture, and we want our music to identify as something greater, further beyond, that brings hope. Mm. All of a sudden, I feel now that the music is mimicking the culture. And once again, I'm using music. We can go to media of any kind. Look at, we keep getting told that we hate murder, we hate guns, but Hollywood loves themselves some guns. John, you've seen John Wick? You know? I mean, oh boy, he's knocking people out quick, you know? I can't even watch a commercial without a gun being pulled out, an AK being pulled out. Yep. So it feels like we're entertaining ourselves with things that are killing us. I think it's a reflection. I just don't know why it's happening and why it churned. I don't know what it was like for you, Harry. I guess you've been out of high school going on a decade pretty soon, but
yeah. And you're, yes, I mean, still talking musically, I do agree. I think there's some mimicking. I think going back to living a healthy lifestyle and kind of the isolation, we are isolating, kind of as Chris was talking about, and I think that's leading to a decline of our flow state, meaning human beings are engaging in less activities that get them into a state of flow, which is a state of total presence. That's catching that great wave and just being in that moment.
And I just did two. I did 2 weeks ago. I did that sermon on creation where I talked about is the creative revelation is one of the. It was the Bible before the Bible that gets us in tune with God, that opens us up. But
exactly. Yeah. So I mean, there's so many different examples. Being in creation, you can find flow states. Doing some sort of artistic activity, exercise, prayer. You know, all sorts of. You know,
that make you alive.
That make you, yeah, really come alive, and really we're all gifted, I think, to find a flow state. You could find a flow state flipping burgers if you love flipping
flow
burgers.
Flow state, what's that mean?
So it's just an expression
like even flow. Sorry, that's a Pearl Jam.
It's an expression of being totally present. So you are doing an activity where you are fully enjoying and focused on the activity. And you're fully present in that moment. Like that is, everything else is kind of pushed out of your head. And that's kind of a flow state, and we all have those. I think, like, surfing's a great example. Being out,
you're a UFC fighter, so when you're punching somebody,
yeah.
When you're punching somebody,
I feel the safest when I'm attacking somebody, and then I know I'm home.
You're a UFC fighter?
Well, I can't say I've fought MMA. I've never fought in the UFC.
No. But he could.
That's a different thing.
Because he started getting hit in the face and going blind for short moments, right?
He did. Yeah, that's another story. But I did. I was trying to avoid some mental health issues myself, and I decided it was time to stop getting punched in the head. So now I just do jiu-jitsu, which is all grappling. And I find a total flow state in there. But the point of bringing that up is when we develop, and I'm seeing this happen with kids all the time, because we offer, I think, flow type events at youth group.
River rafting, which was cool.
We got whitewater rafting, and there's kids who are like, I can't go because I can't be away. There's no Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so kids are missing out on flow, alive state of experiences because they need to be connected.
Because the internet's a distraction.
Right. And so all that.
Not an event, it's a distraction.
It's a distraction and it isolates us. And so if we want to talk about music, there's a possibility that if we are isolating and feeling isolated, which definitely I would say is happening, and we're seeing the music around us speak more isolating, you know, like if the music around us is more lonely and that's what people are connecting to, then I mean, I think there's a possibility, there's a connection.
Yeah, and if you're feeling alive, you're going to be less likely to want to move towards death.
Right.
One of the things I've tried to help people with is to infuse joy into their life. So the word enjoy, and to infuse into. And I remember when I was dealing with, anxiety, really strong anxiety, I realized at one point that I wasn't doing anything I enjoyed anymore. I was actually just trying to maintain sanity. And then actually that becomes a cascading, self-fulfilling, you know, lifestyle that I had to stop trying to get well for a while because I was focusing so much on trying not to be anxious that it was making me anxious. And I had to actually get myself out of it. And I went away and I wrote down a list of things I actually enjoy, was doing and enjoying. And there was nothing on the list anymore. So I made a list of about 10 or 15 things. And then I made a decision that I'm going to infuse these things that make me joyful into my life. One was cooking. One is reading. One is prayer. And every day, still to this day, I try to do 3 to 5 things that I thoroughly enjoy that I don't put in the distraction category.
And the cool thing about that is you can actually somewhat in a and definitely in a positive way, you can get addicted in a sense to those activities.
Oh, you should be addicted to joy.
You just get addicted to whatever that life. State is. Life, you know, man, I just can't wait to cook today.
I'm doing it as soon as I'm done here. I'm getting my kayak and I'm going to Mission Bay. And I did it the other day with a friend. It's fun to invite friends into life. And I was heading down. I said, I got double kayak. Do you want to jump in? And he says, yeah, I'll meet you there at 11. And then, like, seriously, as soon as I'm done today, I know that I got that kayak and it's like this life. That you have to fight for life,
right?
Yeah. And fight to have joy. Chris, you were going to say something.
No, I think I just want to clarify a little bit.
Yeah.
That it's
this is why you're here, because you're speaking. Yeah.
Well, just because mental health issues are different than it's
you can't of, just
you can't. It's kind of like me saying, hey, just work your way out of it.
Right,
just get,
right.
And that's not what you're saying. Just get in a kayak and everything will be okay.
Yeah.
But there's that.
No, but it was part of the mental health solution for me.
And it is. Being in that flow state, like an anxious mind, they get in that state, you actually lose time in that. Like you're doing something, you're so focused that it's like, oh my gosh, 2 hours passed. And in that state, your mind is focused on one thing so that it can actually rest, because an anxious mind is grabbing at everything that comes along.
Oh yeah.
And so you can actually rest when you're focused, which is feels counterintuitive. And I would say, because I want anybody that's listening that has mental health issues or somebody that's committed suicide in their family or friend or is feeling that way, that there's a different space that you find yourself in. And I think using those tools that you just talked about, listing out joy, that's the daily battle of coming and putting yourself in a healthy space.
Right.
And there's also medication. There's also psychotherapy, those
Absolutely.
Kind of things.
Right.
But it is a battle. Life is a battle.
Even when life is great, life is hard.
Well, life should be hard. I mean, life, that phrase, you know, the Stoics talk about it, and that you do the hard things and life is easy, you do the easy things, life is hard. That's kind of popular in circles today. But that I think as a culture, we shy away from those hard things, that we lean back from those hard things. And that even comes to relational connections, you know, that I'm struggling with something.
Right.
I'm not going to come out and say, hey, you know, I just need help. That's the hard thing to do.
Right.
And it's the hard thing to hear somebody. This is kind of turning that corner again. But it's hard to, when somebody tells you something that I feel very powerless to do anything about, our natural inclination is to lean away. If you guys started talking about football, you're like, hey, yeah, football, and you start running stats.
Yeah.
I'm not a football guy. I don't know that.
Yeah.
My inclination is to either change the subject or to just move out of the circle and go to another circle. And
no, you're bringing really good ballast to the conversation, because I'm realizing, like the whole thing about, you know, 3 things a day where I enjoy, we're 4 years removed from my battle with anxiety.
Yeah.
And it got so bad where at one point I thought I was I got anxious that I was going to get lost in my mind, which is terrifying. And I thought, where does my identity exist in my mind? And there are so many neuro pathways in my mind, it can get lost in one of those neuro pathways, and I will get lost. Like if I actually felt like that spaceman who loses contact and floats into space, like does the backward flip somersault, and he's just in space for the rest, you know, till he dies.
And you imagine that. I mean, that you know that feeling.
It's terrifying.
I'm stuck. And to imagine, the only way out of that is to kill myself.
That's how I felt.
That's the answer you get.
Funny, because I was thinking about it, I've had 3 times where I've had to, like, I want to kill myself, and it never lasted more than a quarter of a day. half a quarter day, like three times, ultimately terrifying.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
crazy, out of control, and you don't see any other answers. And so I'm actually thankful that I've had those. I mean, anybody who's had it ongoing for years and years is gonna go, you know, laugh at that experience. But it did allow me at least to see behind the curtain a little bit, and it is terrifying. And yeah, I don't want to diminish.
No, and
it's good. It's great ballast because I think people would be asking that question. That's good. You're here. That's what you do professionally. It's not what I do professionally.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, that's how I thought when I was younger. Like, just get over it. Just go for a run. Just do something. But there's times when that doesn't do it. And that's I think that's just kind of my bent because I've sat with a lot of people there. And those people tend to feel just stuck and isolated and very frustrated because it's so frustrating to be in that spot that these are my only options and I don't want to feel these things anymore. And I'm just tired of it, especially if I've sat with people, again, that have been put on a 72-hour hold, like a college student that says, oh, last time I shared with somebody, they put me in the hospital for 72 hours,
right.
So I don't want to talk to anybody again. You know?
Right.
So that now that was such a painful experience, I don't want to go there. And so a lot of, I mean, talking about suicide and suicidal thoughts, what can we do? That's what I'm curious about. What can we do as a church to break some of the stigma? And the church, again, is way out of what we experienced in the 80s and the...
You know. Our other counselor who worked with us, Corrine Heinzelman, told us that she went to a counseling center and they had a back door for pastors because they didn't want anybody to see the pastors for counseling or anything. Yeah, stigma that goes with it.
Well, there is a stigma about reaching out and getting help, and I do think... You know, especially when we were talking earlier, some of it's about like some people who wouldn't necessarily say they have a mental disorder, but like trying to lead a healthy lifestyle and not kind of get there. But if you're in a place where you have, you know, you're really, really struggling, like counseling, CBT, sometimes medication, those things are super
helpful.
What's
CBT? Not CBD.
No, cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yeah, so, okay.
Yeah, that type of, you know, therapy that really focuses, you know.
What's that other one? It's called like EMF or something? It's emotional... ECF, emotional. Is there another? I heard it mentioned at a marriage conference this weekend. Sorry, go ahead. I thought you would ignore it.
There's all kinds of.
But there's all sorts of. Yeah, so we should, I think, as a church, really emphasize those, really highlight, as we've been doing with you, Bucky and Kareem, our counselors, because there is a stigma and we need it. And I remember it's the only time it's ever happened. I remember I was preaching at our main service one time. And it was first service. And first service, if you've been to first service, is not known for, like, jubilee
exuberance.
And yelling and exuberance, right? And I had said something, I don't remember exactly the topic I was preaching on, but I had said something about breaking the stigma of mental illness and, like, just being okay to reach out for help.
Right.
And the entire, like, everyone just started clapping. And like, it was the only time
I heard that one.
That I've ever had. You know, it's like this, like, standing ovation for this idea.
I get that every week.
Yeah, not in first service.
Not in first service.
Yeah, and that was at first service. So, you know, like, there's a deep desire, I mean, at least within this community, to break that and to reach out for help.
Yeah.
And I do think we can be more proactive, especially about, like, you know, I have people, because I do the prayer team after first service, come to me, and they really have been, like, you know, in tears, just like, I got no options. And how do we... follow up with those people, you know, and get them connected to either you or, you know.
Well, and I think just that, as opposed to the leaning out, just the leaning in.
Right.
You know, if you can lean into a conversation and say, man, I don't know how to help. Let's talk to somebody and let's,
right.
You know. Well, it's funny you say that. Okay, so as a church, we are taking emotional health very seriously.
Yeah.
I actually believe that it is one of the open doorways for the church right now into society.
Yeah, for sure.
And that people, you know, I actually want to put on the church bulletin, I mean, we have the sign out the front, you know, the digital sign that says, if your life sucks, try faith. You know?
I like that.
You know, just, we put a lot of stuff up that's somewhat, you know, open to... open doors for people that wouldn't think we're super religious, which we're not super religious, but we are really wanting to open up this door. So emotional health is one of our core, you know, platforms that we're really trying to grow. One of the reasons you know, Chris, I wanted to do this with you, and that we have you come regularly. This summer, we had a whole series on emotional health. You were part of it.
Yeah, that's fun.
And we have to get better at it. One of the things I do know is that no one, there is no one remedy. You know, if there was, then we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Right.
We would have gotten it, you know, Jared would have gotten it. It would have been a pill. It would have been outdoor kayaking. It would, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
What I am finding is that for every person, there is a different remedy.
Mm-hmm.
But I do believe that there is a remedy for every single person. And I believe faith is part of the remedy. But if, but God might use something besides faith to save them from themselves or from that you know thing. I don't go ahead.
I was thinking about this week as we were just planning for this, that I used to work in ministry, and I would, you know, I lived in probably three different towns as a youth pastor and then an associate pastor. But each time I moved, I was like, oh, this, you know, you just have a community built there. And it wasn't until I got out of ministry and moved again, and I was like, not connected to a church, not, because as a youth pastor, they embrace you and they move all your stuff in and they, and all that stuff. And they just love on you. And there was a mark, I went through a little bit of depression that last move, because I was like, oh, who are my people? Who, right. Where am I connected? And I think that is something that the church has to offer the mm-hmm. world, is just this true fellowship that I care about you. I love you. Even if I don't really know you, that we're in this situation called life together. And and there's that feeling of connectedness and,
right.
and the feeling that, oh, I can go to somebody on a Sunday morning and pray or,
right.
or be heard and have them put their arm on me. That's a huge piece that not a lot of people, I mean, people find it in bars and different places like that, but it's not a real connection of I care for you.
There's statistics on that too. I believe the Pew Research Center, I don't remember the numbers offhand, but they've release statistics that saying people who claim to frequently attend church also have less depression and anxiety.
Hmm.
It's definitely part of the piece.
Yeah, it's a huge, and so that's. I mean, there's statistics, and they're secular statistics. These aren't Christians being like, "Hey, by the way, like attend church, you'll be less depressed." These are secular statistics who've taken a census of people and said. Yeah, people who attend religious community, who attend church, are less depressed.
I had three people now in the 6 years I've been here that have said, three different people who had said that they were contemplating suicide either the night before or that morning and decided to come to church instead, and then told me afterwards and said that they wanted to continue on with life.
Wow.
I believe that, you know, I see every Sunday now as a life and death possibility for many people.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to approach Sunday as a welcoming home. And I had a woman yesterday that said she's exploring faith again. But when she walked up, I remembered her name. Mm-hmm. And it was just random because somebody on the staff had texted me that they had met her. And the name stuck out to me.
Yeah.
So when she walked up yesterday, I said her name. After the service, she came up. She says, "Hey, when I came in afterwards, I got teary-eyed that you remembered my name."
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And she goes, "I've been looking for a home, and I felt like I was at home."
Mm. Yeah.
And so I'm not sure that, I mean, that I can't say the church is the remedy.
But it helped, like what Bucky's speaking about, like community.
Yeah.
It helps. Like there's multiple remedies, and being in community is one major aspect of that.
And I think just being accepted somewhere, you know, in counseling, that's kind of the biggest part of it, is just sharing something and having somebody hear it and say, "Oh, that's
validated.
So that's just that's a bummer," you know, and just and hearing you and it's counseling is a contrived situation, but when you go into a place where people just love you and care about you, then it doesn't hurt. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, fair enough.
Definitely helps, but yeah.
And that's why we're having, you know, trying to have an emotionally healthy church where people can come and be vulnerable and be open. And that's why boundaries is really big for us.
And too. Be unhealthy. That's the thing. I can come and be unhealthy in a healthy place.
Well, it's funny because I say, come as you are, don't stay as you is.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of people that want the church model to be come as you are and be whoever you want to be, whoever you decide to be. And that doesn't work. And what I also know is, we have built enough healthy culture at this church. When somebody comes in really unhealthy, they will either change or they will leave, is what I have found over and over again. And I've been in situations, I've gone to churches that have an unhealthy leadership model. Either sometimes it's too emotive from the front. I remember this pastor got up once and he was just sharing, oversharing on a regular basis from the front. And it made me feel unsafe. And I had just visited there a few times, but his staff culture was unhealthy and it attracted really unhealthy people. It's like when I was in AA, if you don't have a lot of long-time sobriety in an AA group, it's just going to be a mess, you know, with, you know, it'd be like a bar without booze, you know. And so we want to have that. Can we pivot to loneliness? Because that's something people talk to me about, that I've asked the Lord to have a little bit more understanding. And I actually can't ever remember feeling lonely until recently. And I actually said, even through the summer, I've never experienced loneliness. I began to pray that God would allow me to experience it. I've experienced some since then. I don't think I want to experience any more.
Stop asking for it.
It was funny because I went to the mountains. We have a cabin up in Big Bear, a family cabin, and I love going up there. We had just been there the week before with Harry, and it was such a great time with the kids, and we went water skiing. Generally, when I'm done with a week at camp, I just want to go be alone. And so I went back up to our cabin, and I passed the camp, and I felt this extreme feeling of like, hey, my buddies aren't here. You know, I can't have a conversation. And I had to go back to the camp to see if they had a power cord for a computer. And I walked in, and the hall was empty, and it was just a janitor. And it was just so sad and lonely. And I actually came home. I spent the night. I had 3 days to stay up there. My wife had said, go away for 3 days and come back. And I always do it. And I just wanted to get back home. I can't imagine having, well, let's say you were married and then you come to your house and your wife's not there anymore and she's got the kids.
Right.
You know, something like that. Or, you know, I just was at a camp, you know. Are we more lonely, Chris? What's going on with loneliness, bro? Are you seeing a lot of that in your practice? And is that a driver of this hopelessness?
Yeah, for sure. I think there's that, again, we're more connected but disconnected from everybody. And loneliness, you can be in a crowded room and still be lonely. That's right. It's not being alone is not loneliness. But it's people are very isolated. People feel very isolated. And the hard part about loneliness is there's some good research. We did that workshop this summer about loneliness. But actually some really good research. And it talks about the more I feel lonely, the more I perceive the world as a hostile environment. And so I see you as not wanting to connect with me. That's my own perception of the world.
Right.
And so so it's this spiral into a deeper loneliness because I can't connect because I feel like the world is hostile. And so it's harsh. And there's this, I mean, you talk about the social media and that. There's these, what is it, groomed lives that we have or cultivated lives that we have online.
Manicured,
that's the word I'm looking for. That is, the more we put that out there, the more, and we realize that's not me, the more we feel lonely and isolated. Right. Because people, now I've made this thing where you see this person that I put out there, and the real person is back behind there.
Yeah, it's, you know, one thing I struggle with, and I was doing Ugly Selfie Friday for a while, you know, where I would just take a worse selfie of myself. You know, like those pictures now where people blur their face, and they do it on their phone, it looks really good on their phone, and then they push it to their Facebook account, which actually makes the picture bigger. I don't know if you can tell that they do it. They're the soft filter thing.
You gotta find that.
That one. But I'm just like, what? Like, I don't. You by doing that, you're invalidating yourself.
Yeah.
You do that when you do that. The argument would be, well, why do you wear a nice shirt then?
Sure.
But I don't know. I feel like there's a difference when I'm manicuring. I mean, you could say the same thing about makeup. I don't know. Maybe I'm off base here. But
well, it's when you can lean into the truth and say, oh, this is me. And I can take a hard look at me. You can't tell this by just my voice, but I'm totally bald. And the more I can say, yeah, I'm bald. That's it. You know, I have other.
You have a great shaped head, though.
Well, that's why I didn't want to keep this head away from the world. They got to see how my scalp is. But the more it's interesting because it's very freeing to me. I struggle with it all through my 30s of being like, oh, this piece of me is fading away. I took pride in my looks and all that. Not that I don't take pride in what I look like, but there's, but it's kind of freeing because I'm like, oh, this is me. And I cannot hide this anymore.
That's
like
the song from The Greatest Showman, the This Is Me song. You got the bearded lady. You know what I mean? She's singing that song, This Is Me. Just that freedom, though, of, you know, I guess there's...
The more you, my point was, the more you can look at yourself and say, oh...
Comfortable in your own skin.
Well, even if you're not comfortable, if I don't like this aspect of myself, by turning away from it, you actually undermine your own happiness, your own joy, because it's not true. And so you're holding this thing out there, and it just isolates you, and you become even more lonely because I got to keep up these appearances. I think wearing a nice shirt, putting on your best, doing your best work is all great stuff. But to be honest about those parts that are ugly or I don't like and say, I want to improve that, I want to do what I can, or accept that, that's real joy and real contentment comes in that, being your best self at the same time calling yourself out for those things that I don't.
That's why we're doing a podcast and not a video, so we can hide and not have to do it.
Video's coming at some point.
I actually, too, just to expand on something you said, too, Bucky, just a bit ago, that I think even connects to community. You're saying, too, when we feel lonely and we feel isolated, we then perceive others as, you know, potentially unsafe. And then... But and the step further is when we perceive others as unsafe or like they don't want to engage with us and we believe that about them and can pick up on that and they don't
so
know why.
Easy.
And then they actually begin to either act unsafe towards you
or reject you
or completely reject you, and they less likely want to engage with you. Yeah. I mean, there's a study, I think it was, I don't remember if it was Jane Goodall or whatever. I need to bring some like actual
with the monkeys
data. Yeah, I think they did a study where. And I think it was an accidental study where they had people approach these monkeys that they were studying, and some of the people who were most afraid carried weapons, and the monkeys acted more violently, would tend to act more violently to the people who had a gun. And it's not that these monkeys actually had seen people.
Monkeys terrified me, by the way.
And knew a gun. Fair enough. I'm like a little monkey.
Yeah, we go to the zoo, dude. One of those things gets... You ever see what chimpanzees can do? Google that.
Dude, they're gnarly.
You're not supposed to smile at monkeys either, right?
Really?
Because they see it as a thing of aggression.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Baring your teeth. Anyways.
But point is, these monkeys, it's not
That's a good point.
They understand how a gun works. They don't know. They don't really understand that gun's a threat. And in fact, these monkeys hadn't seen a gun before. But it was the people approached it thinking, these monkeys are unsafe. Okay. I need to protect myself.
So for the person, it becomes a self-fulfilled prophecy that I see you as dangerous. I don't engage with you. And then the person, so I get more lonely.
But the people who approached the monkeys without a gun... They were able to more frequently establish relationship and connection than people who approached it and happened to have a gun.
I'm never approaching a monkey, first of all.
Not even with a gun?
Even with a gun.
Yeah, fair enough.
The one of the things, we've all been pastors, and so you're approached by people all day long. Mm. And one of the reasons I struggled at when I was at a very large church is we had to go out in the courtyard. And I say had because I had to. And it just, I was like a pinball machine. And I'd be so exhausted by the end of being approached. And you're approached by so many different people. It is so easy for me to know when someone's not comfortable in their own skin. Mm. And I actually was not comfortable in my own skin probably until I was about 45. I'm 50 now. Mm. And I remember there was these leaders. I'd go to events and I'd want to, there'd be like this really popular leader and I'd want him to disciple me, or I'd want to like have them, I'd go talk to him. I remember I went up to like Louis Giglio one time. There's all these other people and I would like walk up to him and I would try to, I don't know what I'd try to do, just try to have influence or have them think I was awesome or whatever. I remember Eugene Peterson. I did the same thing. I went to Eugene Peterson and I said something super awkward. And I remember the guy just looking at me. And now I realize what it was. Like I actually feigned a tear. I went up to him and I said, man, you've just really blessed me. And I got super emotional, but it was fake. Like I knew it was fake, but I was able to like produce like a teary eye. Yeah. And I remember him looking at me like, and now I know what that look was. It's like, this guy's weirdo, dude. Yeah. Like he is not comfortable. I was having to like be something and put it on. So I have all these stories with really famous people where I've been super awkward. Tony Campolo, all of them.
You've been awkward with all of them?
All of them, dude. Hugged Tony Campolo in the street one time in Sacramento. So long story short, the point was is, I just wasn't comfortable in my own skin. Mm. And when you get comfortable in your own skin, this is one of the reasons I really like Harry as a youth pastor, and especially a 25-year-old, and I met him when he was 22. You don't meet many young people that are super comfortable in their identity and who they are, and can having a conversation with an adult, you know what I mean? Like in their, you know, when they're teenagers, especially.
Yeah.
Unless they've been raised with some very stable people around them. You had your mom that was there, but all that to say, personally, I can tell when people are and back to this conversation of it is a self-fulfilling prophecy, because I realize that really healthy people didn't want to spend a ton of time with me. You know what I mean? Or if they did, it was because they saw that they could bring, you know, they saw some talent perhaps, or something that they, some gifting or some potential.
Right. So how do you become comfortable in your own skin?
I had to give up. For me, it was after my wife's brother killed himself, and my wife hit a major depression, and I had been trying to prove myself in succeeding at work. I'd been writing books, I'd been on TV, there was all these things, and I was getting tighter and tighter, the drum was getting tighter, the social profile was going bigger, the everything that I was doing ministry-wise was getting bigger, it was not another book deal, and all of a sudden, when my wife came to me and said, this just isn't working for me anymore, and I got terrified, because if I was going to go back, it meant that if I was going to save our marriage, and I might have to give up everything that gave me my identity. And I finally got to a place, where I just had a, you know, I won't go into the whole story, but I broke to the point where I just didn't need it anymore. And I realized what was really important in my life.
And that's that piece of taking a real hard look at the truth.
I don't know if you can just decide. Like, you can't just tell somebody to go do it. I had to get broke.
That's the thing. That's the gift in those broken moments. And we choose to shy away and lean away from those. I mean,
I could have gone to the bottle. Could have gone,
Or just say, "Oh, that's their problem and not my problem, and they're wrong, I'm right."
Things didn't get better. I went away for a 3-day retreat, solo retreat, in the height of my anxiety, and I went for a solo alone retreat, and I was listening to all these tapes on the Father's Heart, which is a ministry, and I was and praying and fasting. I wasn't eating anyway. I didn't even need to fast because I wasn't eating anymore. I have pictures of myself. Like, my hair was falling out. I was here my first year. I was like 30 pounds lighter than I am now, and I'm not heavy now. But I got to the place where I just completely was able to give it up. I also went on to meds for a short, which I wasn't doing meds. I did like a year trying to white knuckle it. Like, I'm not going to do meds this time. I'm gonna do, you know, I was doing just every, you know, meditation. I was doing all this stuff.
Yeah.
At a certain point, I needed, my dopamine levels were so, my adrenaline, was so jacked up. I needed some balance. Got on the front foot again. Did that for about a year and a half. And then I weaned off because I didn't want to make that a lifestyle. And I was able to. But all that to say, I got to the place where I was just able to come to this church and hand in the keys. I didn't need another radio interview. I didn't need another book. I didn't need to succeed at this. And I got to the point where I could just be a janitor. If I need to be a janitor, I could work at McDonald's. It didn't matter anymore. And once I gave it all up, all the pressure went away. And everything got better. And I got to tell you, I am way better at what I do now and freer. And when I meet people, like, I meet people that are leaders now, like those people, I don't feel like I have to go talk to them. And if I come into the room, I feel like I belong there. It just changed everything. I don't know. It's just my own journey. But
yeah. And I wonder how much of that is the societal pressure of, I have to be this person, and I'm holding my hand up like a mask in front of me. I have to be this, you know. And
I'm not sure who is trying. Some people try to prove it to God, don't they? Like, God is the person they're trying to, you know.
Or themselves, or, I mean, I think.
Or that, their little brother, or dad.
Yeah,
or,
you know, I just have to be this. And also because, like, that could be the only thing they're finding meaning in, you know. And so there, so to go through life, and, I mean, I think exactly what you just articulated is one of the most powerful things I've learned from you is not to hold on to my life with a clenched fist. Because that's what that's, and I think that's totally cultural. I mean, everyone, you grow up, and especially growing up in La Jolla, it's all about, what are you doing? Who are you going to be? How funny are you? How smart are you? How athletic are you?
You're a product.
It's all, everything is product-based, and what are you going to be? What are you going to do? And for I, you know, and I was the fighter. You know, that's how I got known. You know what I mean? And everybody somehow knew
that. Dirty Harry Wilson,
Dirty
dude.
Dirty Harry, yeah. I was choking out people in taco shops, and and
that was you.
That was me.
I was just getting a taco that day.
Yeah. I know. Well, you know, sometimes justice has to be served in forms that none are just tacos. But yeah. So. And that was, I was clinging to, I got to fight in the UFC, I got to do this, I got to do that. And that's, everybody's doing that. And then something I learned so much from you was just to let go and to just go through and walk through open doors.
Yeah.
The doors that God has opened for you. Yeah. And now, I don't know, you know, I could see all these different trajectories for my life. And it's the coolest thing to be like, honestly, I kind of don't care.
Absolutely.
Like, I don't care. I could see head pastor. Yeah. I could see professor. I could see teaching jujitsu. I could see whatever God has for. I just don't care.
Yeah. Haberdasher.
Yeah. I'm just.
Well, there's that verse. It's for freedom you've been set free.
Right.
Is huge. And to be able to walk in freedom no matter what. And I think I got to the place where I thought, no matter what happens, well, fine, then that's what happens. Right. Just being able to be so loose with it. And the other thing you said was, and I read it today, Proverbs 17:1. I love it. Better a dry crust of bread with peace than a house full of feasting with strife. Yeah. I hate chaos. I hate strife. And I thoroughly love living right now. I thoroughly love life, and I'm not afraid of life anymore.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And strife is different. Strife is an interesting thing because I think my brain goes to, oh, challenges, difficulty, I want to be without that. But that's not strife. Strife is the chaos I bring from ignoring things, the chaos I bring from just living out of my emotions and bringing strife to my family.
Living out of my emotions. Can we talk about that? Let's pivot to that real quick. Mm-hmm. I have, and I mentioned this at the Taco Tuesday night where you spoke and we did the group think. I have been living less out of my emotions. I believe we're living in a world right now that is telling you to live completely, that whatever your emotions feel is truth, which I think is bunk. Just because I feel it doesn't mean it's true.
Yeah.
And feelings are part of my decision making. I also don't want to be some logical, you know, Glockenspiel, you know, emotional Glockenspiel or mental Glockenspiel that just, you know, pumps out, you know, methodical clockwork like decisions. Yeah. But emotions are, I think we're spending too much time in our emotions, right? Because the 70s, we got all cathartic. We went out into the you know, we go into the woods and beat. No, everyone held up. There was stiff upper lip, the Victorian era. There was no emotions that were, have we gone too far, bro? Is that kind of one, maybe we've gone too far and this is one of the things that's.
I don't remember the Victorian era so much.
Oh, okay.
I think there's balance, you know, some moderation. I think that you cannot be ruled by your emotions, you know, that there's got to be balance to that. But everything we do is emotional.
Right.
You know, there's an emotional component to it. I may show up to work or I may be with somebody because
but if
I
somebody,
choose that.
Yeah, but I don't, let me push back on that. I'm not sure everything's emotional. When I was in the bar scene, you meet some chick. You know, there was no emotion attached to
but there's, I think we differ in that because I would say.
There's a dopamine hit.
Yeah, but I think there's also some emotion that you're avoiding, that you're hooking up with somebody. We do things for emotional reasons, that we're emotional creatures. Doesn't mean I have to be ruled by my emotions. It doesn't mean that I have to act on every.
We're seeing more emotion. I saw a lady bang on a car today. And I keep seeing people have huge emotions in public. Mm-hmm. A lady, was crossing and the guy didn't even really get close to hitting. He just kind of moved and there was a sign that said, don't turn on the red. And she started yelling at him. I pulled my phone out because I wanted to take a picture of it. Because, you know, I'm the guy that's going to be taking the video. And she starts banging on the hood of his car.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah, dude. And it was a nice car. And I mean, he was like a 40-year-old man and she's like a 60-year-old woman. What's he going to get out? You know, and push her?
Yeah.
You know, she had the power in that situation. But it's, you know, and last week I heard I mentioned it in my sermon. Some lady screaming at a lady across the street because her dog was in the car. As she got out to go put some mail in a box, and you
know. Yeah, I think it's important. And we mentioned CBT.
Outrage.
We mentioned CBT and cognitive behavioral therapy, and part of the methodology behind that is to notice our emotions. It's super important, kind of when Bucky's talking about as balance. We have to. It's not that we don't want to feel these things. We want to notice. Wow, I'm really angry right now. And then to not be like, I'm really angry right now. There's a difference. You know, like, wow, I'm really angry. And then going in and examining that emotion and be like, well, okay, man, why am I so angry? You know, where does that come from? Or how?
I mean, we should pause before we just act on our emotions.
Wild. It is wild. But I mean, because it could be pointing to something else. If something's so small and made you so angry, like, why am I so angry? Okay, I go back. It's like, well, you know, that person, you know, this line was really long and I was angry. But ultimately, you're probably not angry because the line was long. Like, there's something deep. And so to examine those, first notice the emotion and then step back and examine it and be interested in the emotion as almost as a third party, which takes a lot of practice and is hard to do that for yourself.
Yeah, and also not, there's secondary and primary emotions, like that's what you're talking about. Yeah. Like secondary would be anger, it's protective, it's out there. I can show the world that, it's rather than, oh my gosh, you scared me and I thought I was gonna die right now.
Right.
And cry in the middle of the street. That's what you're probably feeling. But it comes out as anger, and we have well-worn paths to get there. You
right.
know, that something comes up, and I go there. And I think there is definitely people who just give full vent to their emotions
right.
nowadays. And
Bible says you're a fool if you do that.
It's folly that yeah. I turn that over to you, and I say, here, you manage this.
Well, they want me. They want to control me by their emotions.
Yeah, or draw you in, or have.
I grew up in a okay, and this is what's so funny is I grew up in a family. Many of us did. I grew up in a family that was, I mean, had a master's degree, a PhD in dysfunction, and so when people come and try to do the silent treatment on me that I saw my grandma do, oh my goodness, she literally could have taught at Oxford on how to do silent treatment.
Yeah.
And so they try to pull silent treatment on me, or they you know, they detach with a hatchet, and they think that I care. I see it a million miles away. I learned from the best. I got healed from dealing with that. She wouldn't give it to me, but she would give it to other people in the family. You know, and so, you know, I'm not going to be controlled by their bat belt of emotions, and you'll see with people. I don't know if you've noticed this, like if people that are very manipulative, if you know, detaching with a hatchet doesn't work, where they give you the silent treatment, then they'll do that for a week, and when they realize that they don't get the response they want, then they come and they do victim, and then if victim doesn't work, then we're going to do angry, and then if angry, it's like Batman used to have this bat belt back in the day, and he could like reach in and get whatever tool until he finds a solution. And being in a healthy church, one of the things we're really trying to do right now, I think, as a church, is I love personal responsibility. That's a big part of, I think, healing. I mean, if you want to talk about healing.
Oh, for sure.
Personal responsibility of saying, one of the reasons I'm depressed is because I've treated people horribly, and they don't want to spend time with me anymore, and I have broken relationships and dead bodies emotionally all around me because I'm actually a real jerk. Taking personal responsibility is one of the ways I think you can heal. You know, and that's not true for all people with that, but some of our emotional illness we've created, haven't we?
Sure. Well, I think, and not only have we created it in multiple ways, treating people bad, but also as you and I talk about a lot, like when we pack too much up on our plate, you know, and we have no margin in our lives.
Yeah, I become more of an emotional being.
Yeah, all of a sudden we act way more irrationally and emotionally when we have zero margin, you know, and I've witnessed that recently in my own life. So,
yeah, in Scott Peck's book, The Road Less Traveled, that old book, he talks about essentially the
life is difficult. First sentence.
Yeah, there you go.
That's how he starts.
Yeah.
You said that earlier.
And where was I going with that? That he says that many mental health issues come out of avoidance of pain. That we avoiding pain, the pain of asking for what I want. I mean, you talk about why do I manipulate? Because I feel powerless when I ask for what I want. You know, so I'll try and contrive it or get you to meet those needs for me. But when people can say, okay, I realize this secondary emotion, that I use that as a tool, and then they can look at the primary emotion and say, oh, this is what I'm feeling, and then just ask for what they want or say, oh, that's not yours to give me. That's, I have to find that within, or I find that from God. Then you're free to just be yourself and say, oh, this.
Yeah, free to be me is awesome. I love free to be me. I also found that free to be me can be lame too, because You know what I mean? Sometimes you can get so free and so comfortable that you, you know, to hell with everyone else.
And I'm saying you're free to offer the world the best parts of you. You're free to say, like you said, oh, I don't
have to. That's really good, what you said right there. The whole podcast could go on. You're free to offer the world the best part of you. You know, there's an invitation.
Yeah.
I like that.
Mm. And just to, then you're not trying to get the world to meet your needs anymore. You're like, okay, I'm connected to God. God tells me my name and tells me who I am. And then I can offer that to the world. And so, and that's what you experienced in the last 5 years is like, oh, I don't have to live up to and be every, all these things.
Even doing this podcast, it's interesting because the reason I wanted to do it this time is because I actually feel that this church, you, us, myself, have something that's valuable to offer that is actually a commodity that's going to bless people. Whereas 10 years ago, it was because I wanted to be Rob Bell. You know what I mean? Like, I was so embarrassed. I was talking to Mark Foreman, who's our former pastor, and it was like 2005, and we had just been to a conference with Rob and others, and I remember walking, and I said, I don't know why I'm not as big as him. Mm. Oh my God, I'm so embarrassed that I said that, you know? And I said that to, now Mark is a guy, Mark Foreman, my former pastor, is a guy who got what we're talking about a long time ago, and he's not trying to prove anything to anybody, and was really good about not chasing fads and not trying, you know, he is probably, you know, he is less known than he should be, and it's intentional, I think, in a lot of ways. But I remember, because it was early in our relationship, and I if I was him, I would have been like, oh, I'm not going to let that guy preach for a while. Yeah. You know? Totally. And I remember, I'm sure I made him awkward multiple times, because we'd get in a room and I'd feel uncomfortable. Or he would invite me to be in a room with, because he'd always have these people he knew, and I'd get there and I'd feel so like, now you invite me, hey, what's up? Oh, hi, Ted. You know what I mean? Or whoever it is, you know, I don't even care. I'm not there to prove anything.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but that being comfortable, you know, getting to a place where it's, I think it's submission to God. It's letting go and realizing where your identity is.
Yeah. I also really like what you said. And I think it's funny because it seems so fundamental, yet we really struggle to do it. And just want to highlight what you said was to ask for what you want. Because that's
it's so good.
So fundamental.
Oh, yeah.
And
in marriage,
and, it's, and you think, oh, that's exactly where I was going to go. But you think we would get it because that's what we yell at our, you know, like parents yell at their children, like, use your words, like, tell me what you want. Yeah. But we can't do it in relationship. And like, we were in a psychology marriage class my last semester. And as you know, a big part of it is just in relationship, learning to use your words and say, well, I guess I acted that way because I want this. You know, or, you know, I instead of like trying to manipulate to get what you want, simply being like, hey, I would really like this tonight.
Yeah. You're
like, oh, okay.
Don't tell us what that was.
Yeah. Well, you go multiple areas, you know, but.
It's funny, Carrie and I had about 2 years ago, we had some things going on in the family, her and I's relationship, and we went and got into the car in the garage, and we said, we're just going to be honest. You can be completely honest with every thought. Dude, we were in there for like 2 hours, and I said, you know, this is what I think about this. This is how I feel about this. I mean, it was crazy. It was the craziest thing was we both already knew that the other person was thinking and feeling that.
Yeah.
We already knew.
And it's such an amazingly healing space to be
in
that.
Oh, so good.
To speak like this is the real me behind any mask, and to have somebody that you're intimately involved with say, ah, but I still love you and I still care about you and I choose to be in relationship with you. And going back full circle, that's what we as the church, I think, can offer the communities that don't always feel that. You know, there's a lot of stigma. Sorry,
Don't be sorry, dude. You're amazing.
There's a lot of stigma and around mental health stuff that the church has propagated.
Is that still true?
Yeah, I think so.
I don't personally feel a stigma around it, but that just be me personally. You think, of course, we're in California. I mean, we're probably on the, besides the East Coast.
I think kind of more accepting. There's a lot of, you know, we're a therapy saturated culture in Southern California. But there's still, you know, to be in a small group and say, I'm schizophrenic or I'm bipolar or, I struggle with schizophrenia, I struggle with bipolar, then people don't want to deal with that stuff. You know, you don't want to be then, oh, then I become the person that struggles with bipolar in the group, and I become a project, or that's where we go.
Go ahead, Harry.
I was just going to ask, can every relationship do that, Bucky, in the sense of, like, you know, Adam's talking about, you know, this experience where he was able to, they were both able to share everything, and is every relationship, is that healthy for every relationship? Because I kind of...
Circles of trust.
Right. Circles well, yeah, I think it's like, I don't know, I guess I'm just curious.
Well, there's concentric circles.
I think there could
circles.
Be people listening, yes. and...
And I would imagine both you and your wife did a lot of work before that. Of,
to get to
of
that
introspection
point.
And it's yeah people choose not to go there and
right.
So when you can get to a place where it's like oh it's okay and give permission and that's a lot of the marriage therapy that I do is just creating that circle of trust where somebody can say something turn to their
so that's a place we should be striving for in a
yeah,
sense
for sure
and if you just have that with one person that's what I mean one of the reasons God created marriage is to have it with one person I mean there's I will never have that level of intimacy with my daughters because I don't think it's healthy. I'm not going to tell my daughters certain things. You know what I mean? There's,
yeah,
I can tell my wife everything. You know what I mean? But there's things I would never tell my kids. You know what I mean? There's just certain because there are parts of a marital relationship that's why you have ultimate intimacy. That's why that's why I'm going to teach about that this week. But you know, in that the marriage relationship offers us a glimpse or an invitation, love that word recently, that invitation into have complete trust, complete vulnerability, complete openness.
But I'm wondering, is there a, and maybe Bucky, you've seen this or not seen this, is there?
Why is it always Bucky? Why can't I have a question? Throw me a bone.
I'm curious about more his counseling practice is why I'm asking.
Yeah.
You're a
sucker for the counseling practice.
I am, I like it. Is there a place of oversharing to the point, you know, is that possible where, you know, in that you know whatever circle of trust, safe space where a partner shares too much. Like, is there an oversharing, or is that not possible?
I think there's things that aren't helpful.
Yeah, there's things that are unkind.
I don't think it's helpful to leave the bathroom door open all the time and see everything that's everywhere. It's just like it doesn't put
Fair
my
enough.
Best foot
yeah,
forward.
Yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
know, and so
Good.
I think there's some of those things that. That would be hurtful, or I don't have to share about every past relationship I had and the details of that with my partner.
Or if you have a waitress that comes up to us while we're eating, I don't say to my wife, "Oh, she is really good looking."
Right.
I just want you to know that she is good looking. That's no help. Those aren't the kind of things I'm talking.
Well,
about.
I know, but I think it's good to clarify because to say
no, you're right.
to say oh, I can say anything.
Well, and
you know,
well,
it's
I could.
Just good to,
I could say that.
Yeah. Okay.
We might have to work through it.
Yeah.
Don't like I tell the staff
Bucky
all the time.
Next week,
don't make a mess you're not willing to clean
yeah,
up.
Yeah, fair enough.
Well, and there's parts of that like if there's been a marital affair,
right.
that one partner feels like, oh, I just want to share everything so I can get it all off my chest, which it actually does a lot of damage to the other person, and so you choose what you share and what you don't share, and you
exactly
want to be truthful.
I think that's a really good point because sometimes you can share 25 years of marriage that's not going to work for 3 years of marriage.
Right.
I mean, you know, I was in a situation one time where, you know, I shared the openness that my wife and I had to talk about, you know, where we do share. We always tell each other, if you're ever attracted to somebody else, then you need to share that. You know, we're willing to share that. We've shared that a few times over 25 years, and every time the attraction went away as soon as we shared it. That was for us.
As a safeguard to your relationship.
As a safeguard to the relationship,
yeah.
Yeah, like this is not that person's not safe for me to be around.
Because otherwise it gets
buried
and buried
right,
and
right.
becomes a secret.
But I shared that with a younger group of couples and one gal that had been, you know, abandoned or I don't know what it was, but like that did not work for them.
No.
You know what I mean?
That would not work for everybody.
No, it doesn't work for me. You have to have a wife who can deal with it
right.
and a husband that can deal with it.
Right.
You need to tell some husband that he's going to go get his gun.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So I think that's a really good point, Harry, that we, you know, once again, there's no one remedy. And I think as people listen to this, they need to pick out, you need to be your own surgeon and pick out the bits or editor that work.
Yeah, and I'm a huge proponent of having a good guide in that, whether it be a professional counselor or
Holy Spirit.
The Holy Spirit is a great guide. or just a good, healthy friend that can say, hey, that can hold a mirror up to you every once in a while and say, hey, this is what I see. And before you share, even with your partner, say, hey, this is what I'm thinking. We need good relationships with with same sex, you know, our friends as well as our partner. And there's stuff that I share with my guy friends that I don't share with my wife, you know, that because right. it's not helpful for her.
Yeah. I'm not so much.
No, I get where you're going.
Yeah, I think it's really good to have that ballast that you guys are bringing to the conversation, because there are things that aren't, that would be hurtful, you right. know, that you don't want to share. So, but what I like is that for us, we know that anything you need to share can be shared.
Yeah, yeah.
And I like what you said too about, you know, bringing in, this wasn't your exact words, but basically bringing in maybe 25 years of hurt into a 2-year marriage.
Or 25 years of healing.
Yeah, right. Fair enough. You might have to.
Together.
Yeah, that maybe that place is where they get to, if that is a place of that you can share anything. Maybe that's a place that this hypothetical couple can get to. But maybe it's not, you know, in the first couple years, you know.
Well, you don't even trust. You're learning to trust each other.
Right.
You know, I trust my wife implicitly.
Sure.
You know what I mean? I just do, because she's proven to be trustworthy, and she trusts me as well.
Yeah.
You know, and so yeah, we have that. But every marriage has its strength, and so vulnerability might be a strength for us. And we all have our strengths. You know, Strength Finders talks about finding those things that you can really, you know, power on.
That's good.
Probably coming in for a landing. You have anything coming in for a landing?
Yeah. In the back of my head, I want to close with some, because we talked about suicide as a thing, I don't want to leave that open-ended and be just have a talking point.
Mm. Right.
But people who are struggling with suicidal ideation, it's pretty normal for people to have intrusive thoughts if they're depressed or... I would say talk to somebody, and if to the church, to people who aren't in the church, be a listening ear. How do you lean into those conversations? What are some handholds for that? What are you looking for? Somebody who says, "Man, I don't know what to do with this. I'm at a loss. I just don't want to live anymore. I don't want to do this anymore. I'm just tired of it all." Just that kind of it's all futile feeling. When I've left conversations like that and I still think about it, by the time I get home, I'm like, I should probably touch base with that person.
Okay, well, that's a great question, because I tell the staff as well, don't come to my desk with a problem unless you have a possible solution. You know, unless you don't have any solutions, you literally don't know what to do.
Yeah.
And so we do want to be solutions based. How do you create a community of people who are equipped to recognize and assist, I guess? How do they how do you recognize it?
Well, I think you just tune in to people, and those, I would say it's not your job to solve everybody's problem all the time. Mm-hmm. But if there's something that is a blip on your radar that says, oh, that doesn't sound good, don't be afraid to ask a hard question and be like, so you said you just don't want to do this anymore. What are you talking about? And take an extra 30 seconds to say, have you thought about killing yourself? Is that something you're thinking about?
And a lot of people don't have the ability to do that.
Well, I think the reason they don't do that, or we don't do that, is because we're scared to death they'll say yes. And what do I do with that?
Right.
It's the leaning back, like, oh, crap, I don't know. I'm powerless to do anything. So what is the next step from that? It's similar to people just watching somebody have a heart attack and they just stand there and watch because they don't know what. We need a doctor here,
yeah.
And we go to that. So what do you do with that? There's a myth that if I say I'm going to kill myself, it's going to happen. You know, if I say I have this thought in my head, it's going to happen, which is actually counterintuitive. When people get to say, yeah, it's been hard and I've had these thoughts, it actually lessens the desire to commit suicide. Mm. It
right.
actually dissipates that, and
right.
they feel some relief. And so listening and saying, hey, here's a hotline. Let's call a hotline number. Let's find you somebody.
Right. Knowing your resources.
Yeah.
Well, and also realizing, look, I didn't come to the conversation today with as many solutions, because I realize this is going to be hopefully, if we're going to do a podcast called Faith, Facts, Feelings, this is the first conversation of many conversations, because
sure.
we are on a journey to get better at this.
Right.
And so, I mean, both of you guys are both more empaths than I am. Both of you guys are very empathetic, and you're very heart-driven.
Yeah, for sure.
Both of you are, and so both of you shored me up on a few, you know, because I tend to jump and then say, you know, how are we going to land this thing? Which is good, but this is a conversation.
Yeah.
Because we are trying to create one of our things on this menu. We're creating a pub menu for our church that actually is going to go in the pews. It looks like a pub menu. It tells you what we do. You can just look at it very quickly and know what we do.
That's cool.
And one of the things is an emotionally healthy church, EHC. And so this is a conversation to do that.
And that's the other piece I was going to say is taking a look at your own stuff, being willing to be comfortable in your own skin.
Right.
Because if I'm not comfortable, I can't really be a resource to you. It's that putting the mask on yourself first and breathe oxygen so I can help the person next to me. You don't have to be perfect, but it really helps to not be rejecting of any kind of weird or unfamiliar feelings. You know, you got to have some sort of emotional stability to say, okay.
So just coming from Atlanta, yep. Ask both of you, if you could, so let me just use a Disneyland metaphor. Walt Disney, one of my favorite people and dreamers, created the happiest place on earth, supposedly. And there are different things that he did to make it the happiest place on earth. There's no clocks. I don't know if you know that when you go to Disneyland. It's timeless. When you walk in, timelessness can make you feel out of control. So he put a town hall with a fire department and a police station and a city hall to immediately give you a sense of security, but timeless security. The buildings at one end of Main Street are 18 inches higher than the other end. So you walk into, it's short to walk in. It's quicker to get to eternity quicker to get to that happy place. It seems like it's longer when you walk out of an optical illusion. It takes longer to leave, but quicker to get there. It's phenomenal what he did. As a church, and I think about church that way a lot. That's why we built these, bright. One of the things I like about churches right now I don't like about the church movement is worship's in the dark. Like, let's worship in the dark.
Yeah.
All that everywhere. And I get that. That was a necessity because we were renting really cheap warehouse buildings. And I get you want to make it look beautiful. But I don't think that they bring life a lot of times. I don't think going into a dark room at 9 o'clock in the morning is the best thing for people. So thinking through campus like that, the question is, thinking through church, what is the, the taking away of the clocks in a church environment that when people come here, it becomes the healthiest place on earth, not the happiest place. Whoa, we got a little horn going off in the background there. Is that a clown?
This is just one that was already in my head, and I think it would help is one having, not only building a congregation of people who do this, but especially the people who are encountering people like prayer teams, greeting teams, pastoral teams, and teaching and really training people on some of the things we've already been talking about. One is just how to listen, like training people on how to really like listen to somebody, because that actually takes work, Then, so when people come here, they feel hurt.
And knowing when to listen, because it's really hard to listen on Sunday morning in between services.
It's true.
And being able to validate, hey, I'm hearing you this week. Can we, Like, give them tools.
And that's exactly where I was going. So knowing how to listen, knowing your resources or your tools, knowing the questions to ask, kind of like Bucky mentioned, being like, knowing when something blips on my radar and I can ask this question. So really equipping... I would say our front lines to listen to people, to know their resources and their tools, and to better engage people.
So that's a culture, because I try to model. I think I do a pretty good job modeling emotional health up to the front. I think was it you that said? I think you said this is one of the healthiest. You felt like it was a really healthy church. Or maybe it was Corrine who told me that from last. Yeah, it was Corrine.
It is a healthy church, I will say.
You will say, yeah. But I've had many people come say they feel the health, and so we're modeling it. But one of the things I don't want to do is put a thing out there like, if you're having emotional problems, come to our emotional booth. You know what I mean? Because I think then you create an environment that is less healthy by focusing on those things. But I think there's more subtle ways to do it. I love the training of the staff. Obviously, having it on our page, on our website, we have the counselors like yourself, Chris.
Yeah,
That they can go to.
And sorry to jump in last minute. And Am I wrong? Is there's Chris and Kareem, and then there's a free counselor. Kareem.
And then there is a free counselor as well, which is Sissy McAllister. And then we have pastoral counseling as another layer of that. And then we also have courses. So we provide everything from financial peace to life skills, and our courses are part of our emotional health.
So that's just helpful too to note for anyone dealing with any sort of mental health issues, what are and also have a low income.
Having an entry point is one of the things we've realized. So for churches that are listening to this, pastors that are listening to this, when people come in, if I don't have a place to point you, then I have to shoulder the burden of that.
Right. Yeah.
And so I come in, I'm struggling with suicidal thoughts. I have nothing, so maybe we can meet together, Pastor Adam, which is fine. That might be part of the solution. But me saying, hey, we've got life skills on Thursday nights, and we've got some counseling. And so we have all these places where people, we built them, where people can actually land. They have to have a place when they get here to get Velcroed in.
Right.
And so having those things and making them visible and accessible, and that's one of our other things we do. If it's not visible, it's invisible.
Mm-hmm.
Visible and accessible. And so Chris is very accessible. You're coming once a month at least to services, it looks like. You know, we have you up the front and different things.
Yeah, and I think...
Podcasts.
Again, and handholds to say, okay, this is how... These are the entry points. These are the on-ramps into relationship here. These are the on-ramps into what it looks like to be healthy, you know, mm-hmm. to model that, to tie them with people, to have good conversations, to call people to their best selves in, you know, 3-4 different ways. Mm. I think through teaching, through
a multifaceted platform.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I love thinking through those things on how do you really create an environment, because if you don't create the environment, it'll just be created for you.
Right.
And it usually goes to the least common denominator. And so you really do have to be intentional. And the more you invite people in that are struggling with things, the more you have to be intentional on healing and working through those things. And so it really is an act of care and love and compassion to say...
it's something that seems as esoteric as campus design. I love campus design.
And you guys have done some cool stuff here with the...
We've done it on purpose. Because before, in order to go to the fellowship hall, you had to walk out a small door, up some stairs, and into a small door that was, like, dark.
Yeah.
Now we've opened up, you know, if you're not here to visualize it, but we've built a patio that from one room feeds into the other. All the space works together now because I believe that the campus needs to represent the heart of what's going on. And so we've tried to make, and this is a Disney thing, this is completely stolen from Disney, but it's visible and accessible values. You know, it's light, it's bright, it's open. Where we even put people, we're working now, where do you meet people when they come on campus? A safety and welcome team. These are the little things, but all of it has to do with people's experience. And so when a gal walked up yesterday and, you know, I knew where I was in the courtyard. I just happened to be in the courtyard that time. But I met her in the courtyard with a hello, knowing her name. I mean, it was a big deal. And I think if you have a person who's feeling lonely and a person who's feeling depressed and they have something to look forward to where they go there and they feel, you know, that they're cared for.
Feel known.
Known.
Be known.
Right.
With,
and, you know, I know we got to come in for a landing, but, you know, sometimes some people's needs are greater. We have to just realize they're greater than we can.
Well, and it's not ours to solve. Right. I mean, I cannot solve the world's problems. This church cannot solve the world's problems alone.
And we're not a mental health center.
I can.
That's not what I am.
Impact that, and I can do the best that I can and be present and love well the people that God brings into my scope.
Right. And realizing what you do and how to do it. And so this is why we're bringing on people like you and why we're encouraging Harry and, you know, his studies. You know, we also have another pastor that we're thinking about bringing on at some point to run an emotional health component. But we've started that right now.
It's awesome stuff.
But I have to realize what we do. I'm a church. We give people Jesus. We get people saved. We baptize them.
Yeah.
And we help them get to heaven. And then all these other things, feeding the poor, helping the refugee, doing the mental health, is all subcategories of what we're about. I'm about the cross. And in the end, here's what I have to offer the person who's dealing with suicide. The blood of Jesus, the cross. I mean, there's other outflows of how that happens. But I have to keep, for me as a churchman, because I'm a churchman, I'm not a counselor like yourself. You know, I'm not a restaurateur, even though we make food and we do all these other things.
Yeah.
Paul says this as well. All I have to offer you is Jesus Christ and Jesus Christ crucified. And that's where everything goes. All these other things we've talked about go back to that for me. And that has to be the centrality that everything hovers around, because there's power in the cross.
Yeah.
And God's saving power.
And just you sharing your own journey and who you are as a person and how Christ has brought you to this place today, this, all the healing that you've talked about, sharing those things are very powerful, just being real and genuine person. I know we have to wrap up. Eventually we're going to wrap up. The one thing I did want to say is if you're struggling with suicide or suicidal ideation, or if you know somebody that is, there's a National Suicide Prevention Lifeline or Helpline is 1-800-273-TALK or 1-800-273-8255, and that's open 24 hours a day.
Or so text Chris at.
No, I don't want to be a hotline. But,
yeah. No, absolutely. The that idea of just having places where people can go and be, and we definitely want to be that place. So, as we come in for the landing of our first good conversation, I think we started out. Well, it's just conversation. So what I like about conversations is we didn't really plan our conversation. We just let it go. But I think I learned a lot, and I learned once again to, keep my eye on other ways of thinking. And you guys had some really great balance today. So hey, one of the things we want to do at the end of the podcast, if you have any comments that you want to do, put them in the bottom. Of the wherever this is posted, or you can email me, Adam, at ljcfemail.org for responses or any things you would like to have us talk about, or topics or things you want to expose us to that we can talk about. And we will be back here next week, probably going to do 8 to 10 of these and see how that goes. A little short experiment with the Faith Facts and Feelings podcast. Brought to you by La Jolla Christian Fellowship and Chris Bucky Bateman and your practice. Do you have a name for your practice?
You can find me at sd-counseling.com.
Okay.
But it's just Bucky Bateman right now.
Bucky Bateman, dude. So, and once again, it was the Big Daddy, Bucky and Big Daddy A show, or Big Daddy M. We can't really remember. It probably was Big Daddy M. Bucky. I was pretty narcissistic back
top
then.
Top billing right there.
Top billing. So, all right, we love you. We'll see you next week, and hope you got something from this. And thanks, guys. Out.